Ever pick up two books with the same title, you know, and realize they're totally different stories? Well, that's what we're doing today, diving into two Supreme Court cases, both called Williams v. Illinois.
Yeah, both landmark decisions, one from 1970 and the other from 2012, had a huge impact.
We're talking economic fairness and sentencing in one, and then the crazy world of forensic evidence and the right to confront your accuser in the other.
It's interesting, isn't it? It shows how seemingly separate areas of law, they often intersect with just fundamental questions of justice.
Let's start with the 1970 case. Willie Williams, he was convicted of petty theft. A year in jail plus a fine. Seems pretty straightforward, right?
Yeah, on the surface. But Illinois, they had this law that allowed judges to tack on extra jail time if someone couldn't pay their fines.
And Willie Williams couldn't pay. So was he basically serving a longer sentence simply because he was poor?
That was the issue, yeah. And the Supreme Court, they ultimately sided with Williams, ruling that extending jail time for unpaid fines when someone's indigent, it violates the Equal Protection Clause.
The majority opinion even said the statutory ceiling on imprisonment must be the same for all defendants, regardless of wealth. Pretty powerful statement.
Yeah, this decision, it was massive. Shut down the practice of debtors' prisons, forced states to find other ways to handle those unpaid fines without, you know, unfairly burdening those who couldn't afford to pay.
So this case set a crucial precedent. No more debtors' prisons. And it ensures that justice isn't determined by your wealth.
Right. It's a perfect example of the court stepping in to protect individual rights. In this case, the right to equal protection under the law, regardless of your economic status.
Okay. Now, let's fast forward to the 2012 case involving Sandy Williams, no relation to Willie. Convicted of rape based on DNA evidence? Sounds, you know, pretty open and shut, but there's a twist.
So the DNA evidence came from this outside lab called Cellmark. The lab report showed a match, but the analysts who actually did the testing, they didn't testify in court.
Wait, if the analysts didn't testify, then how was the DNA evidence even presented?
Another expert, Sandra Lombados, she testified about the DNA match, you know, based on Cellmark's report. And this is where things get interesting.
Interesting and complicated. The defense objected, arguing that this violated Sandy Williams' right to confront his accuser under the Sixth Amendment's Confrontation Clause.
Right, the Confrontation Clause, yeah. It's a big deal. Guarantees that anyone accused of a crime can directly question those who are accusing them.
So the question becomes, does a lab report like this, does that count as testimonial evidence? If it does, then Williams should have had the opportunity to cross-examine the Cellmark analysts.
That's exactly it. And the Supreme Court, they were split on this.
Split how? What were the different opinions being thrown around?
Well, the plurality opinion, written by Justice Alito, argued that the Cellmark report wasn't created, you know, specifically to accuse Sandy Williams. They saw it as, like, more of a neutral scientific finding.
But wasn't it used to build the case against him? How was that not considered accusatory?
That was the dissent's argument, yeah. Justice Kagan, writing for the four dissenting justices, she argued that, look, regardless of the lab's initial purpose, the report was ultimately used to point the finger at Williams, and therefore, he should have been able to confront the analysts.
So we have this clash between the practicalities of using forensic evidence and the constitutional right to confront your accuser.
Exactly. And because there wasn't a majority opinion, the 2012 Williams decision left this kind of gray area about what constitutes testimonial evidence in these complex forensic situations.
Okay, so let's break down these different opinions a bit more, because this seems pretty crucial for understanding the, you know, the lasting impact of this case.
So the plurality, they put a lot of weight on that initial purpose of the Cellmark report. You know, it was created to, like, figure out a DNA match, not specifically to go after Williams.
So they're saying there's a difference between a lab's objective findings and how those findings are, like, used later in court.
Yeah, exactly. Justice Alito, his argument was that the report itself, it wasn't accusatory. It was how the prosecution used it that actually tied it to Williams.
But, I mean, wouldn't you say that the lab report is kind of inherently linked to the accused in a case like this?
Yeah.
It's hard to see it as, you know, completely neutral.
And that's just it. That's the heart of Justice Kagan's dissent. She argued that no matter what the lab intended, you know, at the end of the day, the report's purpose was to identify Williams as the guy, the perpetrator.
And because of that, he should have had the chance to, you know, to question, to confront the people who came up with those findings.
Exactly. Justice Kagan, she zeroed in on the report's practical effect, right? It directly led to Williams's conviction. So she believed it should be considered testimonial under the Confrontation Clause.
This must have caused a bit of an uproar in the legal world, right?
Yeah.
I mean, all of a sudden, the admissibility of forensic evidence, even something like a DNA match, which you think would be pretty straightforward, was like up in the air.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, it did. The fact that they didn't have a majority opinion, it created this gray area. And then the lower courts had to grapple with how to apply the Confrontation Clause to these really complex forensic scenarios.
This kind of feels like a classic example of the law trying to keep up with scientific progress, right?
Yeah.
We have this centuries-old constitutional principle, and now we're like trying to figure out how it applies to DNA analysis and, you know, and all these other new technologies.
It's a pattern for sure. The legal system always trying to navigate these new scientific frontiers. In the 1970 Williams case, it was all about economic fairness in sentencing. And now, in the 2012 case, we're dealing with the implications of forensic evidence.
Both cases highlight this, like this constant tension between, you know, holding individual rights and making sure that the justice system can actually function.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. In both cases, the court, they were trying to find that balance. In the 1970 case, the right to equal protection, that took center stage, and it led to getting rid of debtors' prisons. But the 2012 case, it left us with more questions than answers, and that's had a ripple effect that we're still feeling.
It really makes you wonder, what's the next big legal challenge going to be as science keeps advancing? What happens when our constitutional principles, you know, they bump up against technologies that we haven't even thought of yet?
Those are the questions that keep legal scholars, up at night. This intersection of law and science, it's constantly changing, and it forces us to rethink our assumptions and adjust our legal framework to these new realities.
Let's bring it back to our listeners for a second. Why should they care about these two, you know, kind of obscure Supreme Court cases? Why does it matter to them?
They matter because they get at principles that are like the foundation of our justice system, right? The right to a fair trial, the right to confront your accuser, the right to equal protection under the law. These are the things that our democracy is built on.
And these aren't just abstract legal concepts. They have, like, you know, real consequences in people's lives.
Exactly. These cases, they remind us that the law, it's a living thing. It's not just words on a page. It impacts people's lives in big ways.
We've gone deep into the specifics of both cases, the legal arguments, the different opinions. But, like, what's the big picture here? What's the thing that connects these two cases that, on the surface, seem totally different?
The common thread, in my view, is that we're always struggling to balance individual rights with what the justice system needs to work, right? How do we make sure things are fair, make sure there's due process, but also let the system actually do its job? It's a tough balancing act, and it's something the courts deal with all the time.
And these two cases, they give us a really interesting look at how that struggle plays out in the real world. Mm.
They do. The 1970 case, it's a clear example of the court taking a stand, a strong stand, to protect a fundamental right, while the 2012 case leaves us with more questions than answers, and it shows just how complicated and messy things can get when law meets cutting-edge science.
So where do we go from here? What are the key takeaways for our listeners, especially those who, you know, maybe aren't legal experts, but who want to understand what these cases really mean?
I think the main takeaway is that the law, it's not set in stone. It's always changing, adapting to new problems and how society changes.
And as citizens, it's on us to keep up with these changes, to be part of the conversation, because ultimately they shape the world we live in.
I couldn't agree more. These cases, with their complex legal arguments and differing opinions, they might seem like something far removed from everyday life, but they really reflect this ongoing conversation we have about justice, about fairness, about the balance of power in our society.
And that's a conversation that affects us all, right? We all have a stake in it. It's wild, right? Two cases, same name, but totally different issues. And yet they both come down to this tension between individual rights and what the legal system needs to actually, you know, function.
Yeah, it shows how complex law really is. It's not just about following the rules, you know, step by step. It's about navigating these gray areas, figuring things out as we go, and adapting to new challenges.
And in that 1970 case, the court really drew a line in the sand, protecting poor defendants from being punished just because they didn't have money.
Right. They saw how unfair it was to extend someone's sentence just because they couldn't afford to pay.
But then the 2012 case, that left things a lot more unsettled, right? No majority opinion. And that's had this ripple effect on how forensic evidence is used and challenged in courts all over the country.
Yeah. It's a good reminder that the law isn't always, you know, black and white. Sometimes there are no easy answers, and the court's decisions can actually create more questions than they answer.
So let's recap for our listeners. Two landmark Supreme Court cases, both Williams v. Illinois. One tackled economic fairness and sentencing, the other dove into the confrontation clause and forensic evidence.
And they both show how the legal system tries to keep up with changing social norms and advancements in technology.
The 1970 case, that set a pretty clear precedent, protecting poor defendants from being unfairly punished based on their economic status. But the 2012 case, dealing with this evolving world of forensic science, it left a lot of uncertainty and debate in its wake.
It's like we explored two totally different legal worlds, each with its own, unique challenges and complexities.
And both cases make us think about some fundamental questions about justice, about fairness, and about how our legal system adapts to a world that's constantly changing.
For me, the big takeaway is that the law is a process. It's not static. It's always evolving.
And as citizens, we need to be a part of that process. Mm-hmm. We got to be aware of what's happening, be a part of the conversation, because these changes, they ultimately shape the world we live in.
100%. These cases, with all their legal arguments and opinions, they might seem kind of distant to some people, but they really show this ongoing conversation we have about justice, about fairness, about the balance of power in our society.
And that's a conversation we should all be a part of. So we'll leave our listeners with this, Kaland. How are courts going to keep balancing individual rights with the evolving landscape of forensic science?
Yeah.
Will we get more clarity, or will things become even more complicated in the years to come?
That's the big question, isn't it? And it's something that'll keep being debated and litigated as technology keeps advancing and the legal system has to face these new challenges.
It's a reminder that the fight for justice never really ends. It's a journey, and it requires all of us to be informed, to be involved, and to be committed to making sure that everyone has access to a legal system that is both fair and equitable.